And welcome back to the Footy Dashi Podcast. I am, as always, Nicholas, and I am here with the delightful Lauren. Lauren, say hi to everybody.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to what I hope is an enhanced audio experience, as we finally have my audio setup working. Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing about any audio setup is that, like, it takes time to, like, dial everything in, so we're still in the process of doing that. So this week, we collectively wanted to talk a little bit about how a lot of the experiences that I've been talking about from my solo dev experience either translate or fail to translate into what honestly is the experience, what is going to be the experience of most people working in the games industry, which is generally working in teams, working collaboratively, and trying to sort of like negotiate amongst a fairly small or maybe even a large group of people what ultimately a game is going to be. However, that said, last time we kind of ended on the note that the solo dev experience and the collaborative, like, team game dev experience aren't necessarily these polar opposites. In fact, there are a lot of ways in which the one actually does translate into the other. And we kind of left off on the example of someone like Kojima, who is in many ways kind of like the core of everything that he produces, even though so much of what you actually see in, you know, previously his games for Konami and now, you know, his games for his own studio is very much sort of the work of these people who have been with him basically since forever. And the way in which they all kind of both buy into his creative vision, but also at the same time, the way in which he, as a creative director, understands that he has to allow people to produce things that are, you know, top notch. So that way, like, everybody feels that they have a certain degree of buy-in in the whole design process. And also, this is occasioned by the fact that Lauren and I both recently watched the Kojima documentary on Disney Plus about the production of Death Stranding. And even though I personally have a lot of issues with the documentary, there's a lot of stuff in there that's really good and I think will help us think through this way in which like large team, like, design processes can still reflect a great deal of what we've been talking about so far.
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely lovely intro. For me, like, what I recognized about, like, a lot of the kind of language you talk about when you're a solo developer, or honestly, like, you're doing your own project, just so we're clear, you don't have to be an indie dev making something for money, right? Like, you can be doing projects and work on your own, is that there are these elements that you ideally, right, have within yourself that are collaborative, like, with all of the people inside of your own brain that want to see different things, especially when you're working on your own game, in terms of, like, level design, encounter design, writing, right? Maybe the narrative, visual presentation, audio. If you're doing all of these things as a solo dev, you have to trust that, well, my scripts might not be the best writing right now, but they're going to work for the mechanics that I'm trying to test. Yeah. But you don't have to talk to anyone about that. And so I just wanted to say that there is this parallel. And so I think that just by putting it and reframing it as all of the decisions that kind of Nicholas is trusting himself to make, the alternative in a larger kind of team collaborative environment. And I think for purposes of this, we can say larger team can be like 4 people, right? Larger yeah. team could be 40, but really best collaboration, like, just so we're clear, starting between like the 4, let's just talk about it as if these disciplines are individuals, and the amount of collaboration and the trust and how people buy into that vision and that whole representative, right? And I also just wanted to do a disclaimer here that anything that we talk about in today's podcast is just examples of different collaborative scenarios based on our own personal experiences, right, in the industry, as well as what's either worked for us or hasn't worked for us, or in the context of the Kojima documentary, what we saw and analyzed from watching that based on the reactions and the things that the developers said when working with Kojima within the context of this, you know, obvious, like, kind of pitch piece for the Kojima studio.
Yeah, right? It's a bit of an ad.
it's a bit of an ad. And so, and it's a, I bought the ad. I bought it, right? I just want to reiterate that, right? Is that the disclaimer has to be there because, like, collaboration is such an individual, right, experience, right? That it's going to be different on every team. It's going to be different as soon as you bring in other individuals, right?
Yeah.
So we're not here to be like, this is the best way to collaborate. If anything, we're actually saying this is just ways of collaboration. And that's really it. It's neither good, bad, best tips. This is not a how to be better at something. This is really just a how to be.
Yeah. And also, I think, well, in many ways, one of the things that I want to do with this episode is kind of give the lie to the whole notion of the solo dev. Because even when you're primarily working by yourself, or like rather, you know, you're generating all of your assets, you're writing your own code, writing your own story and so forth. Like even in that instance, like I'm not really working alone. I still run things, but like I run a lot of things by Lauren. I run things by other game dev friends of mine. Like I talk to my wife about it. I talk to my friends about it. I show them things. They look at something and be like, oh, that kind of sucks. Or, oh, that's pretty cool. I even show my daughter, who is the harshest critic on the face of the planet. And the thing is that even though, you know, I'm quote unquote doing the work, this idea that somehow like it's entirely like it arises sui generis out of my brain, it's just not true. Like that's not actually how it works, even when you're working primarily by yourself. And so I think the reason why it translates so well into the sort of like into group settings where, you know, work is more divided and so forth is precisely because, well, I mean, to stupidly John Donne quote, like, you know, no man is an island, like this idea that we live in a society, things happen around us. And if you design from the perspective of I am this completely like closed bubble, this closed loop of creation, then ultimately, it sort of begs the question as to like who and or what you're designing for. And that's the one thing that I really got out of the Kojima documentary is that like a lot of the people who worked for him when they started working on Death Stranding were kind of not 100% on board.
Or right. Like before we go into that, I think what I want to do is just to like kind of recap what we're going to go with is I think we will be analyzing, right, the Kojima documentary, right?
Yeah.
We're going to be kind of exploring and pulling on that kind of false dichotomy, right, of the auteur and versus, say, the non-auteur design, right? Which I just think is kind of whatever that means. right. And then I think what we'll do is we'll talk about, right, that inspiration, that buy-in kind of that you get from everyone, as well as that collaboration, right? Yeah. So inspiration and collaboration. So first, Nicholas, now please continue about analyzing the Kojima documentary, because I think it really, when you hear and you, if you haven't watched it, please go watch it. And we are not going to spoil the ad for you, but we will just be talking about what they're in.
Well, so, also, like, Death Stranding's been out for a while. I think people know what the game is about.
Right. Well, Death Stranding 2 did just get its trailer released a few weeks back as well.
Yeah.
So continue about analyzing the Kojima documentary and kind of, like, recognizing the push and pull maybe of information, or recognizing, like, that, you know, Kojima is this fantastic auteur. Well, how did his coworkers and people that had to execute his vision primarily think about that when they started the project?
Well, one of the things that I noticed right away is how many shots in the documentary were of like things that various members of various teams brought to him to play with, and not just to look at, but to like play with, and like his annoyance with things or his delight with things, and how much his team were invested in like presenting to him things that he would like, or things that would push him, challenge him, or like present like new ideas. So this idea that like it's interesting. It's almost like his process is less like, I am the dictator of the game, and like you do this and you do this and you do this, so much as like he is there to be like the wizened grandfather, and all of his grandchildren come to him, and they want the little like hard candies that grandpa gives away, and grandpa doesn't have a lot of those hard candies, so they've got to work hard for it. So they do their little song and dance routine, and grandpa's delighted, and grandpa hands out his candies. And I think that's one of the reasons why, if I had to guess, so many of the people who work at Kojima Productions now are people who worked with him at Konami, is precisely because like they are invited and encouraged to like contribute their creative genius in such a way that it's not just about sales, it's not just about production, but it's also about delighting the other people that they work with. And in fact, I've often noticed this in a lot of like animation studios where that have like a really good working atmosphere, or even in instances, because like you'll notice how when people talk about like auteurs, especially auteurs as like directors, one of the things that you'll see is very common with them is that they often use the same crew. They have the same assistant directors. They have the same cinematographer for like every movie that they make. They oftentimes even use like the same group of actors over and over and over again. This is especially true of people like, say, Mike Flanagan, who makes all of those like horror shows and films for Netflix nowadays, because there's a recognition that like if you have a creative vision, you are in fact dependent upon like the sort of like second order creative visions of the people that you work with, and you need to know that that's going to be consistent. And so even though when talking about sort of like an auteur as this person like from whom all ideas and all sort of direction flows, really, when it actually works, in my opinion, and when it produces something that you want to play or that you want to watch, it's often because the quote-unquote auteur knows how to select for and encourage and in many ways like bring up people whose own creative output they deeply respect.
I think that that like kind of hits on like the primary kind of principles that I found myself being drawn towards in the documentary. And one of them was very much about the promotion of the people into decision-making positions from underneath of him. Like a lot of the time you would expect, I think, in popular culture to have a Kojima documentary where if auteur theory really was Kojima just talking the entire time, right?
Yeah.
He'd be like, this was my vision and I wanted to create a world where et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And instead, most of the documentary was people talking about, well, this is the mechanic or the gameplay that we wanted to test, and we presented it to Kojima. Or when he told me his high-level vision, I didn't really kind of agree, but I went along with it anyway.
Yeah.
Which means that like he also, in that moment, right, had to, I think it was, I don't remember if it was the lead designer or like a lead like artist or something, but one of the leads of the team basically said, you know, I didn't agree, but I, you know, he obviously went along with it anyway. The Death Stranding exists, and that means that there was some sort of challenge, right, that probably that lead had to undergo, that was like, I'm not quite understanding the vision. So there's something Kojima has to do to both translate that vision, right, to his team, but just enough for them to then pick up, right, the pieces,
yeah,
that he doesn't see. And I think when you see the pieces he doesn't see, every time I think of people that have influenced my work, from Kojima to David Lynch to, right, Mike Flanagan, not only do they have like the kind of the similar crew or a very distinct vibe, right?
Yeah.
They also say the experience comes to me in pieces. Like these people recognize, right, that there's scenes that they want. There's mm-hmm. flavors, there's ideas of something. And so I think when I was listening to this parts of the documentary, not only where it's like, oh, there's, it comes to me in scenes, it came to me in waves is another way people have described it. Or it's like, I can see the characters interacting, but I don't know how they connect yet. And I think what's interesting is that when then Kojima started to talk about trying to connect the dots or ways of inspiring, right, the team, he was like, well, here's what influenced me. Here's actually the outside world, right, that he started internalizing, the movies, the books, his personal story. And so that was actually what was really started to break down Kojima from a what people assume or want to maybe project, right, as someone who has all the answers as a director. And then instead actually say the people that have that success, or I say people, I don't mean to generalize, but Kojima has found success in a way that, you know, I think is aspirational simply because he was like, this isn't a documentary about me almost as it is about the team and the work that they were able to achieve.
Yeah. And it's also interesting how much of like, this is something that I had a hard time wrapping my head around, which is that he is in so much of the design process, including like voiceover, mocap, like so many of the little things that get done to go into a game. He is there, but he's also not like micromanaging everything. It's more like he is there because he wants to see it happen. He wants to see what's going on. And it's like having the both the restraint to let people like perform and to do good work, but also sort of like the wisdom, if you will, to know when to intervene. And like that's when you are like a project manager, generally speaking, that's a kind of difficult thing to learn. The notion that like sometimes, in fact, the vast majority of the time, you're just going to need to shut up and like be aware of what's going on without actually dictating what's going on, while at the same time being able to recognize when things are kind of going off the rails and that you need to step in, or not even going off the rails, where it's like, in fact, I noticed this when like he was directing like the performance from Mads Mikkelsen, where like he saw some of the things that he was doing, and it clearly like was he's getting ideas from what other people are producing. And if you are going to be a really great creative director, you have to be able to be honest with yourself about your own ideas that are crap, and also be honest with other people about the things that they're doing that are inspiring you, and allow them to do that. Like, take it and be like, yeah, that's really great. Can we do more of X, or can we do more of Y? Because if you want to inspire the kind of like motivated creative activity out of the people you work with, they need to feel like they have something to give to it. And so, interestingly enough, as Lauren was noting, like several of the people in his team didn't necessarily buy into the initial concept of Death Stranding, but the way it was then presented to them was like, okay, you don't buy it. Well, then here is a design challenge. How would you make this work? How are you going to take your own skill set and the things that you do and take this crazy idea? Because let's be honest, Death Stranding is kind of a ridiculous idea. And yet it works.
and it works because there was that like central theme and that central kind of tone and just narrative expression in the game. I just realized the director's cut is free on PlayStation Plus for some PlayStation Plus members that pay way too much to have access to all of the games that you never play. and it is fantastic. And I, with that, like, I just like died. My brain just went straight into it. So reading on my notes here, I think that there was two really key aspects that I really want to tie into. And the first is the honesty, right? As well as that motivation. And so I think that what's interesting here is that the documentary, like to move from a way of the analysis of the documentary exactly, and kind of place this into maybe like particular scenarios that you might be facing in, you know, your own work, or scenarios that, you know, you want to get into games, but you're reading about, and also scenarios that unfortunately we have to I mean, unfortunately, we have to recognize, you know, the current state of the games industry, and we're making a games podcast about how to work well with games people, and recognize that I think this type of episode is more important than ever for just recognizing the lessons that you need to learn, either when you're going to strike it on your own, right? But also when you are one of the people that are affected by all of the layoffs, and now you're thinking, well, what do I do next, right? Yeah. And so I want to talk about those things like honesty and motivation, because I have to be frank that it's very, I guess I have to be honest, it's very hard to have the motivation when you're even employed at a current company sometimes, just because you can see all of your, you know, friends, right, or formal coworkers affected in a way that you didn't expect.
Yeah.
And so when we look at this, right, and in just recognizing that current climate, it's really easy to think, well, I'm going to be a solo dev. And now you get to make all of the decisions.
Yeah.
Right? I don't say it's easy, but I do say it's like, well, maybe I should just strike it on my own. And I only bring that up because I did have friends that were saying that, right?
Yeah.
And so this is where we are going to move into that false dichotomy. We're also really just break apart and kind of like blast a shotgun through auteur theory here.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which it doesn't make sense. I mean, it was one, it's worth noting that, like, at least within film studies, auteur theory was really kind of a way of describing a fairly limited subset of like what were considered to be quote unquote geniuses, while at the same time failing to recognize the fact that like most movies don't get made that way, especially in the periods of time that they were talking about, because especially, you know, if you go back into the Hollywood studio system, the studio system is a system. It was kind of a machine. Like, they used core sets of actors that they had on contract, and they kind of churned them out through film after film after film. Scripts would be not so much produced as digested by this system and turned into something that was put up on screen. And there wasn't really much opportunity within that system. In fact, in many ways, like, the kind of named directors that we know of nowadays were in many ways a reaction to that setup. And that, but to this day, like, for example, if you think about, say, like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and whatever feelings you may have about it, like, even when they bring in like really well-known directors who have like their own distinct style and creative vision, one of the things that's sad to me is the way in which that whole like film/TV universe kind of gobbles them up, but doesn't really like use their forms of creative expression. In many ways, it kind of has to be more homogenous, because there is this thing that people have come to expect out of sort of like quote unquote superhero films writ large. And I understand that some people like that. That's not for me, and that's fine. But those two things are kind of at odds with one another. You see the way in which sort of like this large studio process kind of takes people and like takes people with sort of like very distinct creative visions and kind of flattens them. And that's not always the case, but it is a kind of, I think, an extreme example of the way in which, especially when you're talking about like large productions. So, you know, when you're talking about studios that have, say, 100+ people, or they have like multi, like, you know, tens, maybe $100 million budgets, where it gets into this territory where you as the individual person working on something are adapting yourself to an existing like program of creative direction, rather than like allowing your particular creative expression to sort of influence the way things are going to be. Like, that is actually the rarity. The much more common thing is to actually be slotted in and have a kind of, I don't know, workaday attitude towards what you're doing. So we actually do want to talk a little bit about that. And go ahead.
No, please finish your thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to hand it over to you, because you have a hell of a lot more experience with that than I do. And so you can actually speak to what that looks and feels like in your own work.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you for handing it over to me then about talking about my own experiences and work. I really think the distinction between the slotting in approach into how can I best, right, give myself and have the highest impact on a team, really comes from and breaking apart the systems, right, and the systemic approaches to development. And so I want to like pick apart what you said there, Nicholas, about how like movies don't really get made that way. The studio system back then, having these directors have their name on things, right, was actually a reaction to the system itself and the systemic, right, approach to designing and developing those movies. And so what I really want to call out here and address within my own experience is that there's a reason why I think game development studios, particularly ones that have been around a long time or ones that are trying to build a new team and grow, kind of emphasize and almost overemphasize production and processes and organizational structure, almost in a way that can harm the development process, because they recognize, right, that the system of the means of production, right, determine what is produced. And so if you have a very hierarchical system at your organization, right, you're going to have the director who's in charge of directors. Those directors go out and give their orders, right? And then their team executes on those orders, right? And so in this way, you can already go, well, obviously the creative director, the guy on top, right, is making these decisions. But as we can see, right, even in this means of production that looks very similar on the outside from Kojima, it's like, what did he do to what you could say, like break apart the systems, right, and the hierarchy? And what did he do to like empower those that even if they're, say, you know, literally level five on a food chain of, I guess, decision making, right? A level five has just as much as respect and empowerment and impact as someone that's, say, a level three, like a lead versus a junior. Does that make sense? Just so we're clear, everybody. And I just made that up on the spot. There's no levels. Okay. This is not a video game. I guess if I ever created a studio, this is what I would do. You'd start at level five and work up to level one. I guess it'd be backwards development. Okay.
Also, it'd be like really... the Japanese system where like EQ is the best.
Yeah. It'd be the Japanese. Oh, shit. Oh, I guess so. Yeah, you're right. Sorry. Yeah, I'm yelling in the mic. And I think that what's really interesting, right, is think about the systems that, you know, Nicholas was just talking about. First, there's the movie system. But then I want to talk about, well, if you're working on a Marvel game, what are some of the Marvel systems, the Marvel expectations, right, that you need to fit in? And so I think there's two things here. There's the system of development, right, and organization and process. But then there's also going to be, right, this creative kind of constraints that you have on the team.
Yeah. So in many ways, it might be worthwhile thinking about sort of the difference between the structure of production versus the systems of production, because the systems of production in many ways are sort of a means, a way you get from A to B. So like, you know, that can be technical. It could, you know, part of your systems could be you're working in Unreal Engine. Part of the system could be that, like, you know, you're primarily using a trouble ticket system like Jira to like organize and like, those are the means by which people get things done. But the structure is really sort of the way in which people are organized both with and against each other. And I don't say against in like, I mean that in a purely neutral sense. In other words, there are ways in which people are structured in relationship to each other, both so that they are expected to have constant immediate contact. And then there are ways in which they are separated from each other. Sometimes we refer to this negatively as siloing people, but it's also just a basic recognition of the fact that you don't want your back-end engineers doing all of your primary writing. Like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right. And then, so then that's actually a really great segue into the fact that a lot of times when you have a smaller development team, you're wearing a lot of hats. And so it's really easy to get confused about the structure of how you're organized or where you need to be or what your role is, etc. And so it's interesting that in breaking down this auteur theory, right, there are no geniuses. We're also actually talking kind of about production models.
Yeah.
About where you sit on a team. And I think that's kind of that's the point. The point is that when an auteur comes in and the theory is born that there are these geniuses out there that make everything happen, I'm sure those geniuses are all looking at each other and going, but I didn't do anything. I just kind of sat here and made sure that these things that were churned out all made sense. And when they didn't make sense, I called it out.
Yeah.
It's also, right, the longest running joke that like it sucks to be a director because you never get to be involved in that really deep IC collaborative work anymore. And on the one hand, I have had people talk about that to me because they're like, man, we're not in a lot of meetings anymore. I'm not seeing you as much. We're not being able to collaborate because I really love collaboration and I'm a good collaborator. at least to the people who have brought this up to me. And I'm like, yeah, but I can't tell you the warmth and joy that I feel when people come to me with something.
Yeah.
And I go, like, whether it could be a written document and like just the way they're talking about their work, right? It could be because I am in narrative. It would also be on screen and the way someone calls out like what is a bug that someone else says, actually, we're making that a feature, right? I mean, even just talking about it and remembering things that have happened from work, I can't tell you the warmth that happens in my sternum, okay? This like little chest pit between my ribs, that's what it is. I can't tell you how much joy and fulfillment that brings. Like there's something about having everything coalesce and elevating, almost creating a platform for everyone to step up on. And you're always on the platform, right? So you can look at everything from that high level. But like the invitation of bringing people up onto that stage. And then when they go back and they're actually performing that, like I can't tell you how amazingly I can't. Obviously it brings me a lot of joy. So sorry, Nicholas, I can see.
So would you say that there are like different kinds of validation at play? So if you are like let's assume a fairly like hierarchical structure where like tasks are relatively subdivided and separate from one another. Is there's both a kind of validation, it seems to me, in like if I am one of the people who's lower on that particular totem pole, I shouldn't use that as an example. I'm lower down in that structure. And like producing something and then telling somebody, either like a colleague or somebody I report to, and like having them express to me like, yeah, this was really great work. This was really fantastic. I really love what you did here. Like that's one form of validation. But the form of validation that you receive when it comes to sort of being much higher on that in that sort of organizational structure is from when people come to you with those things and they have produced something that not only meets your satisfaction, but sort of delights you and shows that they actually understood what it was that you were trying to communicate with them and they made it their own. Like that is a different form of validation. And it is a genuine one because it's one that says, like, it wasn't just, they didn't do this thing because I told them to do it. They didn't do it because I made them. I mean, that's part of the reason why, obviously, because we live under capitalism. But they also, in part, did it because they bought into it. And I think that's why the Kojima example is a really good one, because 9 times out of 10, at least what I was seeing from what they filmed, his validation seemed to come from other people coming to him with their own work and in many ways, in their own particular way, recognizing and understanding what it was that he was trying to communicate to them. There's a scene in the documentary where like they show him screening a film that he had seen recently for all of his employees. And they didn't really explain at the time why they were doing that. In fact, one of the problems that I have with the documentary is that they almost try to big him up too much. Like, it's weird how everything that is being said about Kojima in that film, especially by like the non-Japanese people, like basically the people who are not in his studio that they interview.
Right. I know the adverts.
All of those people.
Every like 10 minutes, there was an advert from like, you know, Gabe News. Oh my God, I can't believe I don't know. Forgot his name. Continue.
Well, like, I mean, Jeff Keighley's in the film a lot. And it's like, you know, the people that they're interviewing
in the film a lot,
or like Guillermo del Toro is in it as well.
Yeah.
And like every single time one of them is on screen, they're like, and this is why he is the super genius Hideo Kojima. But then they would show like actual people doing their production work. They would show like the performances from like the mocap and the voice actors. They would show like, you know, systems engineers bringing something to him like to toy around with. And in every one of those instances, it was very clear, at least to me, that like his delight comes from like being there and being present when people do that work. And like just the joy that you get from being like, yes, that was great. You did a great thing. I'm so proud of you. And that's like, Like, that's the way he was actually behaving, while at the same time, everything everybody was saying about him was like, and he is the greatest genius who has ever geniused his genius. And it's like, that's just not on film, man. Like, that's not there.
I was wondering how long it would take for us to get until you started critiquing the documentary. But I think this is exactly, like, it wasn't there, right? And so those are kind of the big three, I think. When we talk about, if you're going to go to game development school, or you're going to go to any school, really, the biggest thing that people talk about, and I'm going to use the big business jargon because I think business jargon is fun, because it is, it's hilarious, is that, like, they always talk about, how do you get buy-in from your stakeholders, right? How do you get buy-in from the people that are going to pay you? Or how do you get buy-in from, you know, in general, how are you going to get buy-in, right, from your team? And yeah, it's all about this buy-in approach, which just, like, reinforces the fact that this jargon came from, you know, like, the white male elite of the old, pale, and stale Yale people. About, like, buy-in, because it's about poker chips, right? I'm all in. I'm buying in, right? This is all, like, very classic poker metaphors.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you need to go all in to a thing, right, you're putting all of your money, you're putting all your bets. You're talking about buying in, right? You're going to buy into this game. You're going to buy into this approach, right? So I think that buy-in is really incredible, because it doesn't have to be agreement. And that's what was really shown in the film for me, is that people were like, I didn't understand. I didn't know what was going on. I was very confused, but I'm bought in. And I think that's the magic, right? When we talk about collaborating on a team, right? And we also talk about the solo developer journey, you kind of have to be bought into your own bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. As a solo developer, you have to be like, you know, I really want to create a world that kind of represents, and I guess in Death Stranding, right, that represents that these crazy people are going to come out of the ground, and they're like, it's darkness, and there's really no fighting. Right. There's no, like, human kind of conflict. There is human conflict. Don't get me wrong. There is.
But oh, yeah. There's plenty of violence in
there's
it.
There's plenty of violence. Like, yeah. So clear. But it's like, it's not about, you know, Sam being the violent, like, perpetrator. How do I say this?
Well, no, anyway. it's not the classic sort of, like, leveling structure that sort of dominates and underpins most games, where it's like, you are the gun guy. You go into the gun place. You use your gun thing to gun down things. And then at the end of gunning them down, you get better things with which to gun. And then you keep getting better things with which to gun.
You keep gunning.
And you keep gunning. You run and you gun, and that's it.
You run and you gun. You run and you gun, right? And I guess that's why I want to kind of, like, address, like, the buy-in and the collaboration aspect, is that, like, buy-in is not agreement, right? And in a team space, right, we're going to talk a lot about the solo dev experience, but, like, it's really easy as a solo dev to forget that you've bought into your own bullshit, because I'm sure there's times where I say bullshit. I'm sorry. I shouldn't, because, like, I too have had my solo projects. And so let me give.
No, I don't take offense to that. I think. Well, OK. Actually,
no. Well, I'm glad you don't take offense, but I was starting to take offense on behalf of all of the other solo devs out there that are honestly really, particularly in this environment. Your work is going to what changes the future of this industry in a time when we do not know what the future of this industry looks like. So whether you are one person, two people, four people, 40, you know, 400, right? Like, we need to change this industry for the better. So I was realizing that it sounded, I was not correctly making my argument. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that sometimes it's hard to remember that you have gotten buy-in when you first start a project from yourself, when you're really excited, you're doing something new. You really want to make a flashlight game where the flashlight is what not only exposes light, but also exposes maybe new information about the world. Like, the flashlight's required. It's like a black light, you know, it's required to see cool glyphs. And by connecting glyphs, you're going to have magic, and then you get new powers, right? And it's all explorational, so there's no VO, and it's all about you and a flashlight, right? But the flashlight has batteries, so you've got to turn it off. So sometimes you're going to be without your power.
Ooh. Yeah, Luigi's Mansion.
Luigi's Mansion. Very easy, right? No, but Luigi's Mansion is a tone, right? So you've got, ooh, right?
Yeah.
But then things get hard, and you're a solo dev, or you're just working on your side project, and you're like, man, like, this game just isn't serious enough. Like, Luigi's Mansion is a bad example for this. But, you know, like, you're like, oh man, like, I just don't think the flashlight mechanic works. Like, I think that in order to really have an experience where players want to use the flashlight, I don't want to these pickups now become like it's a game of like chase. I just need more flashlight battery. And then I go and I use my flashlight. Then it dies. Well, now I have to account for other lighting. What if the flashlight was just always on? And now players can just play this kind of mystical game with like this cool otherworldly vibe. Well, now you're going, wait, you no longer have buy-in, right? It's yeah. yourself. But suddenly when you start to make decisions and you come across these obstacles, what is that buy-in?
Actually, right? That's a really good point, because oftentimes people experience their own doubts as if they're just like something that is automatically there in your head. And they don't think of it as being in many ways analogous to sort of like the doubts that you can experience externally, like if you're working on, say, a team, where they're not the same thing, obviously, but they are analogous. And there are ways in which, like, for example, okay, just speaking from my own work, I don't know if other people are like this, but, you know, when I'm creating visual assets, I do that entirely separately, and it's sort of like a different version of myself from the person who is like sitting down at the table with pen and paper trying to work out all of the math for the encounter design, which is different from the person who is just like sitting with, you know, Visual Studio open and just typing out code for hours at a time, which is different from the person who's like writing the story and all the sort of like the branching paths that can take place. Like, in many ways, you yourself have to kind of personify the subdivisions. The only difference is that you're never in a position where you have to put together like a deck of slides and present to yourself what is going on, because it's still in your head. Like, you can just consult your own head. But at the same time, like there are conflicts that can arise within yourself between, say, like, and this is something I've struggled with a lot personally, is that like, I want to both tell a story. I want to, like, there is this world that I want to evoke, that I want to get across to people, but also the recognition at the same time that, like, I am making a game. And therefore, if I just have text that appears on screen and you click through it, that is not really communicating anything through the gameplay experience. Like, the story can still be really good and it could be well written and compelling and so forth, but it's not compelling in the same way that like getting someone to interact with and sort of like experience what a character is experiencing, not because the game is telling you what they experience, but because it's sort of revealing it to you through gameplay mechanics. Like, having the restraint to be like, okay, the writer side of Nicholas wants to get this particular point and like story beat across, but encounter design Nicholas is like, no, that needs to be more open, precisely because if it's not open enough, it's going to feel like you're just railroading your player. And even though those two people are me, there is a conflict, there is an antagonism between them that is analogous to the antagonisms that you might experience in your own, say, writing work or like, you know, narrative systems design work, and like having to work with like whoever's doing combat or working with like whoever is like doing the back end for your game. Just the realization that's like, there's only so much memory that we can use for this, so you're going to have to try and like trim it down a bit.
Right. And I think what's really hard too is that you're also sometimes when you're on these larger teams, right, I'm gonna throw this in, is that both writer Nicholas and encounter design Nicholas, right, are making decisions about their work in those moments. The first is, we want or we need a story beat here. And encounter design Nicholas is like, well, we need openness here because this is about choice.
Yeah.
And not about a linear experience, right? And now you can kind of see where, like, oh, well, if it was about railroading, or say if it was about a linear experience, he's making an Uncharted game in a visual novel. Well, suddenly it doesn't matter, right? It's all going to lead to a central beat, right? But no, encounter design Nicholas is not doing that. And writer Nicholas is like, yes, but this story is really important to show that the character is developing a certain way. So now the both of the Nicholases come together and have to have almost an argument that at a larger studio, it's not an argument necessarily, it's a creative discussion, but would create conflict in that, okay, I have a presentation and these are the needs I have as a level designer. Okay, well, I have the stories that I need to tell and these are the stories or whatever. or it could be combat moments that we need to have. It's like, well, I want to create puzzles. Okay, this whole level is about shooting a bunch of zombies. Okay, well, puzzles need to be done slowly. You see, zombies are very quick. So what are we going to do? I guess we'll separate the levels that have zombies from the levels that have slow puzzles. And then now you get Uncharted. I know that zombies, Uncharted doesn't have zombies. But now you get the, oh, traversal combat, traversal combat. You get to see the systems. You get to see the patterns, right?
Yeah.
This is really fun for me because I really love pattern matching and making connections, right? So connections is obviously one of my favorite games on the New York Times website, puzzle stuff. And what really like boils down to, right, is that collaboration is about collective decision making.
Yeah.
It's about recognizing how your decisions affect others, even if that other is just the other you. And it's all about recognizing how those decisions add together. And so when we look at this in the context of the auteur theory, is that that's really the auteur, not an auteur. It's the director's right job to kind of like look at those kind of directions in the form of the documentary. It's Kojima. Let's not even give him a title because I don't know what his title is. Studio head, CEO, director, creative.
I honestly don't know what his title is.
Bro.
Chief bro.
Dr. Bro. Sir, Mr. Dr. Bro, Esquire. Sorry.
Who is a lawyer Kojima. Now too?
it is Kojima's responsibility, right? For him, I think that came through for me. Was in that collaborative, right, and collective decision making. And right. And what's really important here, I think, for me to kind of just, I think, highlight from something that you said is the reason of that buy-in requires that inspiration.
Yeah.
And also that it requires, right, that kind of conflict and that tension. But someone at Kojima, the reason why I think sometimes he gets the people that look at it from the outside, Nicholas, and are going, he must be a genius, is because of that fact that he is not actually maybe constantly antagonizing, right? He's not self-antagonizing. He is collectively seeing that antagony work itself out into something that creates that joyful experience that is him viewing. Do you see all that conflict you had? It's all actually coming together and the picture is forming and I am delighted. And in your metaphor, here is your grandfather's candy.
Yeah, and then grandfather pulls out the Werther's original and places it directly into the palm of the child, who is so delighted to have received it, but then sticks it in their mouth and goes, sorry, I don't like those. But I think that's actually a really fantastic point that you're making, because it once again goes back to the idea that, we can look at this from two different perspectives. That one, conflict is not inherently a bad thing. And I think what we're trying to sort of like tease out are the ways in which conflict, antagonism, or just like two things sort of butting up against each other and not really immediately meshing. Like, you can approach it one way and look at it as like, oh, this isn't working. F this. Like, throw it on the ground. Like, you could look at it that way. Or, and I think this is, for me, the primary lesson that I got out of the Kojima documentary is that you could look at the ways in which those things are conflicting with each other and actually see that is, in fact, a creative opportunity. Like that negotiation between those two things. Like in the case of sort of my hypothetical example, where like the writer and the encounter designer aren't necessarily like they want different things from that moment. It is possible, if we're going to think about this, say, like in Marxist terms, to kind of do a dialectic approach to that, to recognize like actually there is a way we can synthesize these two things that is not identical to either of them, but yet still sort of pushes us forward. There's still progress that is made. And in many ways, that synthesis may in fact be something really novel, really unique, and really enjoyable for players to experience. So when you experience those kinds of conflicts, let's look at it from two perspectives. If you're the person who's sort of like farther down on the totem pole, one is to sort of not see conflict as like your own personal or your team's failure, but as a creative opportunity for you to sort of rethink what you're doing. But then if you're the person who's sort of overseeing this whole operation, or if you're someone who's like, a middle manager, or like maybe not the creative director, but say maybe like a lead for a particular team, to look at that conflict and instead of immediately diving in to intervene to fix everything, actually going like, wait a minute, maybe this needs to play out. Maybe I need to let these things butt up against each other, because what will come out the other side is actually the thing that we're going to use and that we're going to ship. Sometimes. Not always. Sometimes it is actually like things are falling apart and they're going bad. But having like the personal wisdom to sort of like understand the difference between those two, like, again, that's a very different perspective, and it's one that I think you kind of have to have if you're in more of sort of like a project management style role.
And with that, I guess I'm going to close us out here by telling everyone to watch the Kojima documentary, particularly because of just how much kind of raw potential and use it could have into your own work and insight. Not so much for the ad sections, like the adverts are great. I also am a fan of Kojima's work, but kind of recognize and kind of break down what I hope really, for me at least, in watching the documentary is seeing a future of an industry where we can't all be Kojima and somehow have Sony say, I'll bet on you, individual, yeah, with no game idea. But what are the ways, right, in which that you do have maybe a side project, or you and your friends are working on something, or maybe you're at a company where you're not sure or you're uncertain about the future, right? What are the ways that you get that collective decision-making, that buy-in, and that inspiration for you to turn what you have and the impact that you can make right now in the present moment to kind of guide us and progress us forward into an industry where hopefully we get to a place where people are like, hey, you're like No Name Joe. I saw that you did this the No Name Joe game. I will totally invest in you some, like, you know, small money to create a studio, right? And maybe we'll be in a better place, right? But for now, we're here on the Furudashi podcast in this glorious month of March. Everybody go have a really fantastic St. Patrick's Day, or have had a good St. Patrick's Day. And we will see you next time in this beautiful collective collaborative experience that you can engage in on our Patreon, where we have our classroom episodes that are a little bit more educational, as well as on our Twitter.
Well, the Twitter has not been updated in forever. I would suggest, you know, that if people want to keep updated on sort of like thoughts that we have about things, we also have our Substack, gamedesigndiscourse.substack.com. That's a really great place to go for, like, a lot of what we post there is kind of more in-depth analysis of issues that were brought up in individual episodes. So if this episode has been a really great experience for you, later on this week, there will probably be a post about it.
There absolutely will be. So look forward to that. And we'll see you next time, everyone. Thank you. Good night.